Okay, well, thank you very much, David, and I'd like to say thank you to the people of the KITP for letting us do this. You know, I really hope this is going to be a fun 2 weeks, and so I'm really grateful for the opportunity to convene this meeting to talk about topological insulators. And I'd also like to thank my co-organizers, Xu Cheng and Leon and Lawrence, for all the leadership and guidance they've shown in putting this thing together. So, it's really great because, most of the contributors to this field are in this room, are at this workshop, and so it's really nice to be in a situation to have that. So as far as my contributions to this have been, this started off as a collaboration between myself and Gene Malee at the University of Pennsylvania, and then after that we were joined by my students Liang Fu and Jeffrey Teo, and particularly Liang, who's here, has really played a key role in all the contributions that I've made, at least, to this. And so what we've discovered is a new electronic phase of matter, which is an insulator, okay? But it's an insulator with a twist. And so what I want to do is I want to try to explain to you what the novel properties of this new insulating, topological insulating phase is. And in order to motivate that, what I want to first talk about is just the insulating state, okay? And so we all learn about the insulating state. When we're very young, and we can basically think of it as a collection of atoms, where the electrons are, sort of bound very tightly to each of the atoms, and so the electrons are bound so tightly that it takes a finite amount of energy to kick any one of them out, and so there's an energy gap to electronic excitations. Now, when you bring atoms together closer together in a crystal, then the electrons start to interact and things get to be a little bit more complicated. But, this is one of the real triumphs of quantum mechanics in the 20th century, was learning how to describe that. And so what emerged in the 20th century was the band theory of solids. Which basically takes advantage of the fact that a crystalline arrangement of atoms is periodic. Okay, and so so one can define a unit cell, and the whole crystal is periodic, and that allows one to write wave functions as a product of some plane wave times some periodic function of R. So this is called Bloch's theorem, and it's really this insight that allows one to completely understand the electronic properties of crystals. And so the idea now is that the momentum is defined now in what's called a Brillouin zone, which so is to say, let's suppose we're in two dimensions, kx and ky, defined between minus pi and pi, like that. And so the Brillouin zone is really, it's periodics, because this point and this point are really the same point. So the Brillouin zone in two dimensions is really, it's really like the surface of a donut. It's a torus, okay? Or in d dimensions, it's a d dimensional torus, okay? And so one can understand the electronic states as a function of momentum, which lives on this torus, and that defines a band structure where one can imagine plotting the energy as a function of, say, k, or k in this Brillouin zone, and one has a sequence of energy bands, which looks something like this. And if the Fermi energy then is between these energy bands, then one has an insulator, and there's a gap separating the occupied electronic states from the empty electronic states. Okay, and so so this is the standard band theory of insulators, and it's the existence of this energy gap which sort of defines the insulating phase of matter, and it's really characterized by the absence of any low-lying electronic excitations. Okay, so the question one can ask is whether this is, whether the energy gap, you know, is a sufficient condition for having an insulator. Okay, and the answer is that actually it is not, because there's a very beautiful state that also has an energy gap in just this way, which is not an insulator, and that state is the integer quantum Hall state. And in the integer quantum Hall state occurs when you have a two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field. So let's suppose there's a magnetic field perpendicular. Okay, and so what you know is that you know, electrons like to go around in circles, like cyclotron motion, and that leads to a discrete set of energy levels called Landau levels. Now. So the Landau levels really constitute a band structure, okay? In the following sense, when there's a magnetic field, things are a little bit more complicated because translations in the x and y directions in general don't commute with one another in a magnetic field. But if you define a unit cell whose area encloses one flux quantum, so one can define a unit cell that big, then the magnetic translations, you know, in this unit cell do commute, and one can, you know, classify the electronic states according to their crystal momentum in precisely this kind of Brillouin zone. And so the energy levels so they're all flat. So one has the Landau levels, okay. And again, if one has some integer number of electrons in this unit cell, then those will fill an integer number of these energy bands, fill an integer number of these Landau levels, and there will be a gap. Okay. So really, this is a band structure. And in fact, you could further imagine imposing a periodic potential in this unit cell, something that was periodic with this unit cell. And then these flat Landau levels would disperse. And if you looked at these two pictures, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them. Okay, so they both look like insulators, okay? But in fact, this integer quantum Hall state where one fills an integer number of Landau levels is not an insulator. If you apply an electric field, say EY, then what happens, you know, when you have a crossed E and B field, the cyclotron orbits drift, and one gets a current, you know, say JX, which is going to be sigma XY times EY, and sigma XY in this integer quantum Hall state where you have, say, n filled Landau levels is quantized at n e squared over h. Okay, so this state which occurs, you know, and this is something which we've, you know, been studying for almost 30 years, is not an insulator. Okay, and so the question that you can ask is what's the difference? Okay, the band structures look just the same. Okay, and the difference really has to do with a question of topology. Okay, and one can think of the band structure is for every point in this Brillouin zone, there is a some cell periodic wave function. And so the band structure is characterized by a mapping from the torus, which is a Brillouin zone, into the Hilbert space, which is the wave function. Okay? And so the beautiful thing is that those mappings can be classified topologically, and that there are non-trivial topological classes. Okay, and so the different topological classes could be distinguished by what is in physics called the TKNN invariant, after David Thallus, Komodo, Dennis, and Nightingale. So they discovered this in the early 1980s. And mathematically, in the mathematical literature, this invariant is called a Chern invariant. Okay, and what it is, I'll write down the formula for it. I'm not gonna do too much with this, but it's basically okay, so it's the integral over the Brillouin zone of something that's sort of like a curvature. And so let me just, as an analogy, what this is sort of like in geometry there's this famous theorem called the Gauss-Binet theorem, which says that if you take a surface and you integrate over the surface the Gaussian curvature, okay, then the result of that integral is quantized. And moreover, the value that it's quantized at tells you the topology of the surface. It tells you how many holes the surface has. So it distinguishes a sphere from a donut. Okay, and so really this is a similar sort of thing, except now instead of being in a real vector space, it's in some sort of complex vector space. Okay, and so this Chern invariant, in fact, distinguishes the trivial insulator from the quantum Hall state. In fact, what Thallus et al. Showed was that this n is precisely the n in sigma xy. Okay, so that when sigma xy is equal to zero, then n is equal to zero, and that's the trivial topological class. But the quantum Hall states are additional topological classes, and so this really goes a long way towards explaining why the quantum Hall effect is so robust. Okay, because it's really has a topological origin. Okay, so one consequence that this has is for talking about the states at the interface between two different topological classes. Okay, and so these are edge states, and so in general, if one has an interface, say, between let's suppose we have n equals 0, which is an insulator, and n equals 1, which is going to be a nu equals 1 quantum Hall state, then just from simple reasoning, an electron which is in the integer quantum Hall state, let's think of this as just a hard wall, it could sort of skip along the edge. And so you expect that there should be some sort of extended propagating states that live on the edge. And in fact, if you solve the electronic states, so let's imagine, so we still have translational symmetry in this direction, and so I can make a plot of, as a function of, so let's say this is x here, as a function of kx, I can plot the energies, and I'll plot it in a one-dimensional Brillouin zone, going from minus pi to pi. And the states are gonna the sort of bulk states have an energy gap, and so one expects that it'll look something maybe like this. Okay, where now, so I'm only plotting it in one dimension now, so there's gonna be a sort of a continuum of bulk states in the valence band. and a continuum of states in the conduction band. Okay, and so, but in addition, these propagating states are going to connect the valence band from the conduction band, and so these are chiral edge states. Okay, and so. And so these inevitably occur at the interface where this topological invariant changes from one value to another. And so one thing that you can see from this is that these one-dimensional states, which are sort of localized at the interface, they're sort of topologically protected. There's nothing you can you can imagine changing the Hamiltonian, you know, near the edge, and that can change the details of the dispersion. You know, maybe you know putting in some wiggles or something like that. Okay, but the thing you can't change is you can't change the fact that one state goes from the valence band to the conduction band. Okay, and there's nothing you can do to without messing with the bulk state to change that. And so in that sense, these edge states are really topologically protected. Okay, and it's a fact that these edge states occur with you know at this interface. It turns there's a very nice solvable model that you can write down to see this, and so so let me just write this down. So a solvable two-band model is just to imagine that you have. So you have two bands which can, where you have Pauli matrices. Okay, so this looks like a two-dimensional Dirac Hamiltonian. Okay, that's what this looks like. And if I put on a spatially varying mass, so let's have it as a function of y, let's have the mass change, which couples to sigma z. Okay, and so what this describes is if the mass is constant, then this is just going to describe some massive relativistic dispersion. Okay, but if the mass has a kink in it where the sign changes, so if the mass looks like this, then the gap essentially, you know, changes sign. So if this is, you know, m of y as a function of y, okay, then it's reasonably straightforward to show that there are going to be states which are sort of bound at this interface. So there's, you know, the states have to decay exponentially in the gap here and here, but there's going to be sort of a state which lives exactly at the boundary. And these states sort of have a long history. This model comes up in many, many different contexts. So for instance, this model is the Sucher-Verheger model of polyacetylene. And, you know, a soliton in polyacetylene has these zero energy mid-gap states. You know, similar ideas come up in quantum chromodynamics, where the goal is to be able to describe chiral fermions in four dimensions, and what one does is one extends it to higher dimensions and writes down some sort of interface like this as well. Okay, and so these domain wall fermions, which are bound to a domain wall between two topological classes, that's a sort of a very general phenomenon. Okay. All right. So far, all I've done is give you a way of thinking about the quantum Hall effect. Okay, and again, the quantum Hall effect is, you know, been around for a long time. It's nothing new. What's new is what happens when you think about insulators that have time reversal symmetry. So, you know, in order to have the quantum Hall effect, you have to have a magnetic field. Okay, and And so what we have discovered is, and when you have time reversal symmetry, the term number has to be equal to zero. Okay, so there's nothing. So as far as this topological classification, there's nothing left. And what we've discovered though is that there is a Z2 topological invariant. So there's a new topological invariant which distinguishes a new type of time reversal invariant insulator. And so the mathematics of that is a little bit subtle. Okay, but the way I can motivate that for you is by thinking about the edge states. Okay, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw a picture of that's analogous to this picture. And so, but I'm only going to draw half of it. Okay, so I'm going to draw the momentum going from zero to pi. Now, of course, it'll also go to minus pi. But if there's time reversal, then everything that happens at k also happens at minus k. So I'm just going to draw half of it. So there's going to be some valence band, and there will be some conduction band. And, you know, if it's an insulator, it has to have an energy gap. And then, you know, depending on the Hamiltonian of the surface, there may or may not be bound states that live on the interface. Okay? But if there are bound states, then one thing that we know, if there is time reversal symmetry, and these are so the electrons have spin a half, and when one has time reversal symmetry, the states have to come in pairs, Cramer's pairs, and so at k equals zero, they have to be degenerate. Okay, so any surface state that occurs has to be degenerate. Now, of course, if there's no interaction between the spin and the orbital degrees of freedom at all, then every electronic state will be degenerate, spin up and spin down. Okay, but if there's a spin orbit interaction, then the degeneracy is only protected, say, at k equals zero. Once we're out here, the Cramer's partner is at minus k. Okay, so in general, there's going to be a splitting. Okay, k equals pi is another one of those points. So pi and minus pi are the same points. So the states have to be degenerate here too. And so one could have a situation where it looks like this, you know. And maybe there's another one. Okay, where they connect up like that, okay? And in this state, you could imagine changing the Hamiltonian in such a way that you pull these down, push these up, and get rid of them completely, okay? And so this state is as trivial as you can get. But what you can realize is that there's another way of hooking these up. There's one other way of hooking them up, and that's to do this. So again, from zero to pi, here's my valence band and my conduction band. So it could be that, you know, I have my pair here and I hook up to a pair like that. Okay? And so then if you do that, then it has to be that the edge states connect the valence band to the conduction band. Okay, and in this situation, there's no way you can get rid of them. You can push things up as much and down as much as you want, but you're always going to have, at any crossing, any Fermi energy that you cross, there's always going to be an odd number of crossings. Okay, you could imagine, you know, it could look like this. Okay, there might be three, but there always has to be odd, whereas in this case, it always has to be even. Okay, and so these two, whether it's this possibility or this possibility, is topological in the same way that this is topological. Okay, and so so this has to reflect some topological property of the bulk, which this is the edge of. Okay, and so that's the content of this Z2 topological insulator. The Z2 topological insulator is the insulator that does this on the edge. Okay? All right. So then the question you could ask is does this show up in any real materials? Okay, and the first place that I stumbled on this was in thinking about graphene. And graphene, it's instructive to think about graphene. So let me tell you a little bit about graphene. So graphene is a two-dimensional material. And so if I think of look at the dispersion of the electrons, it forms these cones, okay? And so there's a point where the valence band and the conduction band touch each other, and these points are described by they sort of have a relativistic dispersion described by Dirac equation. And actually, in graphene, there are four of them, okay? The four comes from the fact that there are actually two points in the Brillouin zone where the bands touch, and so there's sort of a valley degeneracy. And then there's also two spins, okay, up and down spins. So, and in fact, there's sort of deep reasons why these Dirac fermions have to come in even number. There has to be an even number of them, okay. So where I got into this is I was, you know, so there's this degeneracy which says that these two states have to be, the conduction band and the valence band are degenerate at this K. And so the question I asked is how robust is that degeneracy? And if one doesn't worry about spin, then this degeneracy is protected by symmetries. It's protected by parity and time reversal symmetry. But if you allow for a spin-orbit interaction, So you have the Dirac equation which describes this. If you have a spin orbit interaction, then it's possible to write down a term where it has a mass. And so sigma z is the sigma that is coming from the Dirac equation. And then there's these other degrees of freedom, which can be plus or minus one depending on which valley you're in, or plus or minus one depending on what spin you're in. Okay, and this term here respects all the symmetries that graphene has, and so in principle it should be there. Okay, and this changes the dispersion into one which has a gap. Okay, and so graphene is an insulator. Okay, but it's actually this model is nice because it's really SZ is still a good quantum number. Okay, which means I can write this as, you know, a Hamiltonian for the up spins plus a Hamiltonian for the down spins, and the up and down spins are completely decoupled. Okay, and it turned out that if you look at this, that both the up and down spins are actually in quantum Hall states. Okay, and one can there's a churn number for the up spins, which is say plus one, and a churn number for the down spins, which is minus one. Okay, and so this state, the up spins are in a quantum Hall effect, and the down spins are in a quantum Hall effect. And so this leads to the notion of a quantum spin Hall effect. Okay, and so if I apply an electric field, say EX, then the up spins are in a quantum Hall effect, which means that there's a Hall current for the up spins, which goes this way. The down spins are in a quantum Hall effect with the opposite sign, So they have a current which goes that way. And so there's no net current. The two currents, the charge currents, cancel each other, but there is a net spin current. Okay, and so so there's a J sigma, which is J up minus J down. Okay, and so and moreover, this spin current is quantized in the same way that the quantum Hall effect is quantized. So this is the quantum spin Hall effect. Now, in addition to this spin current, if since each of these is in a quantum Hall effect, there have to be edge states. Okay, so if you imagine that you have a sample, a strip that looks like this, then for the up spins, there have to be edge states, you know, say going like this on the top and the bottom. Okay, so this is for the up spins. And for the down spins, there have to be edge states, and they have the opposite quantum Hall effect, so they go in the opposite direction. Okay, and so if I looked on a particular edge, if I looked at the energy as, you know, the dispersion on a particular edge, then you know, there would be some so there's the you know, there's the valence band and the conduction band, and then there are going to be edge states up and down, which have opposite velocities, okay? And so these edge states are something new, right? Because, you know, they're not like the chiral edge states in the quantum Hall effect, which only go in one direction. There are states going in both directions, but the states going to the right are spin up, and the states going to the left are spin down, okay? And so that leads to something new. And moreover, what this predicts is that even though there's a gap in the bulk, it should be possible to conduct electricity on the edge. Okay, and in particular, it predicts that so these edge states are sort of like one-dimensional states, and they should have a conductance which there are two in this strip. There are two states going to the right, and so that means there should be a conductance, at least in the limit t goes to zero, equal to 2 e squared over h for a two-terminal conductance. If I run a current going back in this direction,
can it produce a gap because you have things going in both directions?
Pardon me?
Can impurities produce a gap? Could you scatter a spin up one way to skin this?
Ah, very good question. The answer, if there is no electron interactions, then the answer is no, they cannot. And the reason for that is because if an electron backscatters, it has to flip its spin. And that violates time reversal symmetry. It's like operating with SX, and SX is odd under time reversal. That term is not allowed in the Hamiltonian. So if you have time reversal symmetry, then elastic backscattering is forbidden by time reversal. Okay? And even more, if you have random impurities, usually in one dimension, when you have random impurities, you get Anderson localization. Okay, and the reason you get Anderson localization is because the elastic backscattering is a relevant perturbation which drives you to the localized phase. Well, that doesn't happen here. And in fact, for non-interacting electrons at least, it's impossible to localize these states. And that's one of the beautiful features that they have. So yeah, that was a very good question. Thank you. Okay. All right. All right. So the problem with graphene.
Charlie,
yeah.
Are you telling us that real materials that have Coulomb interactions, this doesn't work for?
No, I'm not saying that. No, I'm saying that if you have Coulomb interactions, it's possible to get into a phase where there's a gap at the edge. If the interactions are strong enough, then it's possible to spontaneously open a gap. And in order to do that, that requires asymmetry breaking. Okay, so basically time reversal symmetry has to be spontaneously broken. Okay, and that could happen if the interactions were strong enough. And in that case, there would be a gap on the edge. Well, strong enough, so the dimensionless, measure of the interactions, which is the sort of the interaction divided by the velocity, has to be order one. Okay.
And there's no hope it's not some sort of a funny perturbation that in epsilon of it will.
No, weak interactions we know will not do that. So what I know is that if you have weak electron-electron interactions, the most relevant, so the first term that can backscatter you is a process where you backscatter two electrons. Okay? And that process is irrelevant perturbatively if you expand around non-interacting electrons. So weak interactions doesn't do anything. Okay? But if you have strong interactions, then that process can become relevant. Okay? All right.
You have to break T reversal.
Well, the state that you get at strong coupling will violate time reversal symmetry.
What is
it? It's a magnet. It's a magnetic state.
So there's a spin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. All right. So as I was saying, there's a problem with graphene, and the problem with graphene is that it is made out of carbon, and this effect relies on a spin-orbit interaction, and the spin-orbit interaction is very weak in carbon. Okay, and so that was a problem. That problem was solved when Xu Cheng realized that mercury telluride quantum wells provide a new realization of this. Okay, and so. You see, the problem with carbon is it's up at the top of the periodic table where the spin orbit is weak. The bottom of the periodic table where the atoms are heavy are the ones with strong ones, and mercury is down at the bottom. Okay, and so the idea was to look at a sandwich where you have cadmium telluride, and then mercury cadmium telluride. It's an alloy, and then cadmium telluride. And so what Bernevig, Hughes, and Zhang showed is that for an appropriate thickness of these layers, you can get into a regime where this two-dimensional layer gets into this quantum Hall, quantum spin Hall state. Okay, So this was a real advance, and this paved the way for the beautiful experiment by Lawrence Mollenkamp. And let me just bring that up. Let's see. Where's my button here? Oh, here it is. Okay, so, we're on. Okay, yeah. Okay, so Lawrence Mollenkamp and Marcus Koenig, who are both here as well, constructed these mercury cadmium telluride quantum well structures. Did sort of a two-terminal conductance measurement, again, where, if you measure the conductance along here, then one expects to get a Landauer conductance of 2E squared over H. And so what they did is they made this quantum well structure, and they could do two things. They could look at different widths of the quantum wells, okay? And so for the narrow quantum wells, those are predicted to be in the conventional insulating state. And so as they sweep using a gate voltage, they can sweep the Fermi energy through the energy gap. And when it's in the energy gap, it's a really good insulator. Okay, in the wider quantum wells, where the band structure is inverted and is predicted to be a quantum spin Hall insulator, then at least as long as the samples are not too long, then they see this nice 2E squared over H conductance. And moreover, they can do this for samples which have different widths in this direction, and the conductance is 2E squared over H independent of the width. Okay, and so that's evidence that it really is carried by the edges, okay? And so really, it's this experiment and then one other one, which hopefully I'll be able to tell you about, which really is the reason we're all here this week, okay? So this is really, really something. Okay.
Is this
Yes.
Does this have have to be done at low temperatures?
Yes. So so let's see. T equals 30 millikelvin. Yeah. I mean, so look, these energy gaps are not huge. Okay, so you have to be in a regime where you're not thermally populating the states above the energy gap.
It's also dependent on
the. Yeah. So the energy gap is what? It's like 30 millivolts, something like that. Is that 20 millivolts? Okay. So that's, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, good. So I told you that elastic backscattering is forbidden, but backscattering a pair, inelastic backscattering, is not forbidden. Okay, and so if the sample is very long, then that will happen. Though you expect that as you go to lower and lower temperature, that should get weaker and weaker and weaker. But if you go to a longer and longer sample, eventually it's going to win out. Okay, and so this data was in a longer sample. Okay, and these were shorter.
But backscattering is still elastic, not elastic.
Excuse me?
It is still elastic.
Still elastic?
Elastic.
This is elastic? I'm not sure what do you mean?
For backscattering, I think
it
still conserves energy.
Oh, no. Elastic from a single particle point of view. I mean, yeah. I mean, the point is I backscatter an electron, I kick up another one. That's a two-particle backscattering process. Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right. How do I turn the lights back on? Can you do that? Okay. Okay. All right. So another direction that this field has gone in has been the realization that this effect could also occur in three-dimensional crystals. Okay, so let me tell you about the three-dimensional. Yeah, certainly.
What about the fractional spin-hole effect?
What's that?
Fractional Pontes spin-hole effect.
The integer spin-hole states with opposite spins. Can you do that with the fractional? Get fractional hole states?
I'm not sure about that. Yes. Okay, Xu Cheng says yes.
You need Landau levels. So these are just band structures. So you need there's a way to get Landau level without any magnetic field. And I will talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Okay. You can.
All right.
But you need Landau levels.
All right.
Without magnetic field.
I mean, you need to break the Amorous symmetry.
No. Realize Landau levels, up magnetic field for upstream, down magnetic field for downstream, no net breaking of tandem versus symmetry. So that was a proposal quite early on for strained semiconductors.
Right. Okay.
Strained.
So strain acts like a magnetic field.
Elastic.
Yeah.
Strained.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so let me move on to the 3D stuff. And so there was this summer a couple years ago where there's sort of three different sets of groups sort of came up with the same idea almost at the same time. I think the first one was Leon Balance and Joel Moore, and then also Rahul Roy, who's also I think here, and then Jean Malie and Liang and I, and so I'm going to argue that that you can have these states in three dimensions again by appealing to now the surface of the three-dimensional crystal. So in the surface, the states, the surface is two-dimensional, and so the states are described in a two-dimensional Brillouin zone. So this is the surface Brillouin zone. Okay. And again, if you have a time reversal invariant system, then one has Cramer's theorem, which says that the states have to come in pairs. And now, so certainly at zero, the states have to be twofold degenerate. And at pi, zero, they have to be twofold degenerate. But then there, you know, there are four of these points where the states have to be degenerate. So I can call them, you know, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and lambda 4. And so the point is that one has, you know, these degeneracies between the states at any one of these four points. And, you know, really, these degeneracies, if you think about it, you know, they get lifted in any, if you have a spin-orbit interaction, they're lifted in any direction. So these degeneracies are really, they're really Dirac points. Okay? But if I go between any pair of these, then the picture would either look like this, or it could look like this. Okay, and which of these two pictures is again a topological quantity? You can't smoothly go from having it look like this to having it look like this. Okay, and so that suggests that there should be, you know, a bunch of Z2 invariants which tell you, you know, which picture you have on any pair of these. Okay, and so what these invariants are going to do is they're going to tell you how it is that the Dirac points that occur at each of these points are connected to each other. Okay. And so what it turns out is that there are four Z2 invariants which characterize a three-dimensional crystal, and they sort of come in two groups. The so one of them, which really is the most important one, I called nu zero. It's a scalar in the sense that it doesn't pick out any direction. And what it does is it basically tells you whether there are an even or an odd number of Dirac points sort of below the Fermi energy. Okay, so so it tells you you know, even okay. And then there are three more invariants, you know, nu 1, nu 2, nu 3, which sort of form a vector, which picks a direction. And what they do is they tell you sort of which of these points will have the Dirac point below the Fermi energy. So they tell you the location. Okay, so, you know, so, yes. Okay, so there's a bunch of phases that one can have. And so first let me tell you about the...
These nu's are all independent? I mean, if nu zero is odd, is one or odd,
yes.
Then all the other nu's keep zero.
So new one, new zero, yeah, these are all independent. So there are four, you know, each one of these could be zero or one. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, there's no constraints on no constraints. Right, there's four independent numbers. So there's, in principle, there's 16 different phases, okay? Though, you know, some of these phases, because since this is a vector, some of the phases are sort of rotations of each other, okay? So, so when nu zero is equal to zero, so we call this a weak topological insulator. And the way you can think about that is that this vector of, you can basically, so this is basically related to the two-dimensional state. And so I can think of sort of stacked, you know, the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall insulator state. So I can imagine taking a bunch of two-dimensional ones and stacking them in a direction, you know, which is the new one, you know, new two, new three direction. Okay, and that's what you get. So the physics of this weak topological insulator is really closely related to the physics of the two-dimensional quantum spin Hall state. Okay. Now, the states with nu zero equal to one are something which is really different. Yeah?
That need not necessarily be the case. I mean, you could have, like, You could have a Schur number changing of 2 or something, which would still be in the weak insulator, but it need not be stacked. Like, so you can have...
But it's adiabatically connected to a stacked one. Okay. So, so for nu equals 1, which is a strong topological insulator, then there's an odd number of Dirac points. And the point is the odd number can't be 0. Okay, so you always have to have them. And so the simplest case is where you just have 1. And so so you could have a situation where you have, say, the Fermi energy sort of encloses 1 Dirac point. Okay, so this is, let's suppose this is, you know, EF. So that, so really what you have is you have something like this, where the Fermi energy, you know, where you basically just have a single Dirac fermion. Okay? And so this is something that's really new. Okay, so it's sort of like graphene. You know, graphene has Dirac fermions, but graphene has an even number of Dirac fermions. Okay, and this one has only 1. Okay, and there's a theorem which says that in a two-dimensional system, you have to always have an even number of Dirac points. Okay, there's a fermion doubling theorem.
If you have time reversal symmetry.
Yeah, if you have time reversal symmetry, right? And so this gets around that, and the way it gets around that is that this is living on a surface, okay? And the other one is on the other surface, okay? But they're spatially separated from each other. All right. So this state is really a new kind of state, and just like in the one-dimensional version, it's sort of robust to disorder. You can't localize these states, okay? And you know, there's sort of a there's a coupling between the spin and the direction. So for instance, the spin, you know that opposite points have opposite spins, and the spin sort of has to rotate around so that the direction of the spin is correlated with the direction of motion. Okay. So. All right. So then the question you can ask is whether this material shows up anywhere or not. And so to this end, I spent a lot of time poring through old band theory papers. And Liang and I had developed some tricks for how you recognize a topological insulator based on the band structure. And so what we came up with was an alloy between bismuth and antimony. And which one of these? Okay. And so the prediction is that this alloy of bismuth and antimony. So bismuth and antimony are both semimetals, which means that they have a valence band and a conduction band, but they sort of they overlap each other. It turns out if you alloy them, then there's a region of concentration where there's a finite energy gap. So the band structure would tell you it's an insulator. Okay. And so what we were able to show is by looking at the band structure, we were able to convince ourselves that it should be a topological insulator. And so the prediction then is that the surface, there should be these surface states, and if you go between a pair of these time reversal invariant points, the prediction is that there should be an odd number of points where the bands cross the Fermi energy. Okay, and so so Zahid Hassan from Princeton got a hold of this and did a angle resolved photo emission experiment on a bismuth antimony crystal, and so what this is the photo emission data, which you can basically read as a plot of the energy as a function of momentum for the occupied surface states. Okay, and so so you see these bands. So they're these these bands, and you're he's sort of doing a cut going, you know, between two of these time reversal points in the surface Brillouin zone. And so it's nice. He sees so there's a point here. So this is at one of the time reversal points where he sees two bands coming in and they cross here, which is good because they should be Cramer's degenerate at this point. So it's good that there are two, and then they split, and then you count the crossings. There's two here, three, four, five, which is an odd number. Okay. Yes.
So do you? I mean, since we only have the energy spectrum for below E equal to zero, let's say, if that's the line that you have there, do you know if it's the situation where you have multiple bands or if you have one band doing something like this?
Well, from the data, no. You need a calculation.
And what's
Liang, what does it do? We did the calculation.
Because the bands 2 and 3 connect, you mean on top of the Fermi energy?
Yeah. So in fact, it depends. So it's a subtle problem because if you do the calculation using the tight binding model that is published in the literature by Liu and Allen, what we were able to show is that you get the wrong answer. Okay, and there's a subtle reason why that tight binding model is wrong. So it's actually a non-trivial thing.
So 4 and 5, so that's very close.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question: why whether that's an accident or whether there's some deeper reason for that. Yeah. Okay, but certainly the fact that these two cross it seems like this is not an artifact. Okay, so.
Do they always see this endpoint surface that is below the Fermi level? I mean, in principle, it can fluctuate up and down, right? They can.
Yeah, I don't remember the latest whether I think they always see it below, but I don't remember the details of that.
And moreover, they have done more experiments, not just along gamma bar to m bar power point, but really along different cuts in the surface room also. So the data are all consistent with each other.
So does that break the degeneracy between 4 and 5?
Along other directions, yes.
How do you know what are surface states in such an experiment?
Well, okay. So the question. So this is the question for Zahid. But what he is able to do is look at the behavior of the surface as a function of both energy and momentum. Okay. And the point is that the bulk states should be momentum resolved, whereas the surface states should be the z component of the momentum should be very broad. Okay, and so he uses that as a tool for separating the surface and the bulk.
So are
there
impurity because this is an alloy, right? Yeah. Are there impurity bands in the middle of the bulk energy gap?
Not that he sees. I don't. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I think it has been discussed in the literature.
Well, in transport experiments, the existence of the impurity bands has been discussed, but I don't think they've been seen in spectroscopy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay. So. Let's see. It's 1:20. Should I quit now or should I keep going? What? 10 minutes? Okay. Yeah. I can finish in 10 minutes. So I just want to do. So I just want to say a little bit about. So now we have. We have this state, okay? So we have it in 3 dimensions, we have it in 2 dimensions, okay? And so I think the charge for this meeting is to figure out what are the interesting things that we can do with it, okay? And is there some new physics that can come out of it? And so what I want to focus on is the surface states of the strong topological insulator. This is something which is really new. And so on one hand, you know, so one set of interesting problems that one can address is understanding the transport in these surface states and the role of disorder and the role of interactions. I think that's an interesting thing. And maybe even understanding the role of, the interplay between spin and the orbital degrees of freedom. But where things are really interesting is if you can figure figure out a way to make the surface states have an energy gap. Okay, and there are various ways you can do that, but since the surface states are topologically protected, one has to break a symmetry in order to do that. And one can do that by either breaking time reversal symmetry or by breaking sort of a gauge symmetry and putting it in a superconductor. Okay. So I want to talk about those two possibilities. And so the first one, you know, so symmetry breaking. Which can lead to a gap. And so the first thing you can imagine doing is just applying an orbital magnetic field. And what that leads to is to basically Landau levels and a surface quantum Hall effect. And this is actually interesting for the following reason. If you have Dirac fermions and you put them in a magnetic field, then it's a well-known problem that they split into Landau levels. Okay, and the magic thing is that there's always a Landau level right at zero. Okay, this n equals zero Landau level. And in particular, you know that the Hall conductance has to jump by E squared over H every time you go through a Landau level, but this one's right at zero. Okay, and so the Hall conductance has to be odd about this. And so so if it's up here, you're going to have sigma xy, which is plus 1/2 E squared over H. And down here, it's going to be minus 1/2 E squared over H. Okay, and so in general, if you know the quantum Hall effect is quantized at half integer values. Okay, now this physics actually turned up in graphene. Okay, so in graphene, you know, one of the things that really got graphene on the map was the quantum Hall experiment in graphene, where they observed they saw this 1/2, but of course that 1/2 was multiplied by 4. Okay, so it ceased to be a fraction when it was multiplied by 4. Okay, so really they observed an integer quantum Hall effect. Okay. Whereas here we only have a single Dirac point, and so this 1/2 is not multiplied by an even number. Okay. And so this is.
I imagine if this is a 2D system, and you're looking at the edges.
Edges of what? Edges of what?
You're thinking here of a 3 topological insulator with a magnetic field, or a 2D.
Yeah. But when you say edge, what edge of what?
Boundary of the boundary zero.
So you're asking the right question, Carlo. Carlo, you're asking the right question. So the point is, if you let's imagine you have a slab. Okay, so you have sigma xy, you know, equals 1/2 up here. Okay, and then you have a sigma xy equals 1/2. Down here as well, okay, and then there's a single, so you don't have any problem with there being a single edge state that goes along the edge, okay, and so this is a so there's a, you know, there's some censorship going on here, which is that I don't think you can measure this 1/2 doing a conventional transport experiment because the top and the bottom are always glued to each other. You can't cut the top off, okay, and measure the top by itself, okay, and that's and for that reason you always have integer edge states, okay, but nonetheless maybe one can come up with some other way of measuring this 1/2, and I think this is probably one thing that Xu Cheng is going to talk about later on, okay.
One just do optical conductivity measurement.
Sure, but that's not going to give you something which is quantized in the way that the transport experiments are quantized.
But why would a transport experiment not only see the top if I just make a contact on the top? Or is there some...
Oh, because it's you can't make it not be connected. I mean, yeah.
You can use optical measure to measure a curve or Faraday rotation.
Sure, but look, the 10 to the ninth quantization of the integer quantum Hall effect is that's coming from the transport geometry. You can't do that kind of experiment. That doesn't mean that there aren't other experiments that one could do to maybe try to approximately measure the 1/2. But you're not going to exactly measure the 1/2 the way you can exactly measure the churn number in a quantum Hall state. Okay. All right. So. All right. So maybe you could also, instead of doing an orbital field, maybe you could apply a Zeeman field, or some other, you know, maybe a field in the plane, or some sort of time reversal symmetry breaking perturbation, which doesn't give you sort of Landau levels. Okay. And in that case, you know, the Hamiltonian, I could have some. So I have my Dirac, equation, and then there could be so this mass term then, you know, violates time reversal symmetry, and this could open up an energy gap in the surface states, and provided you can arrange it so that your Fermi energy is in the energy gap, okay? Which may be, as a matter of practice, it may be hard to do. But if you could do that, then depending on the sign of this mass, you could also get into this sort of quantum Hall state where sigma xy is going to be plus or minus 1/2 e squared over h. Okay, and so I think this would be something that would be really cool to be able to measure. And it may be that one wants to think about the role that, you know, disorder plays in this kind of physics. I think that's an interesting avenue for research. So let me just close by talking about another way that you can open up a gap on the surface, which is by putting it in contact with a superconductor. Okay, and so now let's imagine we have a, you know, just an ordinary S-wave superconductor, and we glue it to a strong topological insulator. Okay, and so this is going to lead to, you know, so I can describe that by Hamiltonian, which, you know, so I can have some Dirac, you know, so this is the Dirac term, and then there's going to be, so the superconductivity will sort of leak into the surface states and make them become superconductors, and so there could be some term which looks like this. Okay? And so this, you know, is sort of a, you know, ordinary sort of S-wave superconducting state, but now of the topological insulator. And so so this superconductor will have a spectrum of Bogoliubov quasiparticles, which will sort of look like this. Okay, so I can have some, you know, E is a function of K. And, of course, the story for Bogoliubov quasiparticles is that the positive energy states are really the same states as the negative energy states, because one sort of doubles the Hilbert space when one talks about those. But nonetheless, there's an energy gap to forming them. And the thing which is interesting about this, so this is a highly non-trivial state. Okay, and the thing that is interesting is that if there is a vortex in the superconductor, then there will be a state, in the core of a vortex. Okay, so. At equal, you know, an exact zero energy state in the core of a vortex. And this state, since we doubled the Hilbert space in writing this down, it's really only sort of half a state. Or another way of saying it is that two vortices define one state, which can either be occupied by a fermion or not. Okay, and so so this is sort of this defines a Majorana fermion. Okay, and so you know there's a big effort to find Majorana fermions. So Microsoft KeyStation, that's the, you know, maybe that's its primary mission is to discover the Majorana fermion. Because the reason it's interesting to Microsoft is because with the Majorana fermion, if you can manipulate them and control them, then maybe you have a way of making a topological quantum computer.
Is this an issue for Microsoft?
What's that? Well, I guess they want to write the software for it, but yeah.
The Fermion symmetry system is a mixture between S and P level, right?
So Pardon me?
The Fermion symmetry in such a system, because the Fermion is not conserved, should be a mixture between S level and P plus IP. Then whether this is a topological thing can be...
Why is parity not conserved? You mean because of the interface?
Surface, yeah.
It doesn't have to be.
Whether it's conserved. So think about a Cooper pair on the tunnel from an S-wave superconductor on top of the topological.
Yeah. Surface. Let me put it this way. If I can just write down a two-dimensional theory, this does not break P.
I mean, this is a similar model was studied by Gokko, but for the Rashiba
right,
system
but,
with superconductivity in Rashiba system. In that case, it's a mixture between S-wave and the P plus IP.
Right, but this is not. This is not a mixture.
No, so it's purely P wave.
No, it's purely S wave, but whether it's S wave or P wave is you have to think about a choice of basis. It's like the P plus IP superconductor, but it doesn't break time reversal symmetry. Okay? And this term here has S wave symmetry. This is a rotationally this pairing term is rotationally invariant. Okay, so this is S-wave. The thing that makes it different from an ordinary S-wave, it has to do with this term. Okay, but this is the difference. This is what makes it not an ordinary S-wave superconductor. Okay, a Majorana fermion has never been observed in a condensed matter system. In fact, I don't think a Majorana fermion has ever been observed in any system. Actually,
we don't know.
Well, that means it hasn't been, if you don't know. Right? I mean, you haven't done the smoking gun experiment, which tells you whether it's Majorana or not. That's what I would be satisfied with. And now, of course, so one promising system to see this in is the nu equals 5 halves quantum Hall effect. And so that's where there's a lot of effort going on. Maybe this is a new venue where we can get at that physics. Okay? And I'm hopeful that we can make some progress on that. And that's one of the things I want to hopefully discuss at this workshop.
Easy way to
understand, but this would be a layer of state. Well, the question is whether you have this zero energy state in the core of the vortex, and is there an easy way to see why that's the case? I can write down some models where you can see it in an easy way, but I'm not sure that would satisfy you. But once you have this zero energy state, then you can see that it's half of a state because the state here, the quasi-particle state, where I add a quasi-particle is the same state when I take a So these two are really one in the same state, and so the states are sort of paired, but this one doesn't have a partner. It's its own antiparticle. Okay, and so that's what a Majorana fermion is. A Majorana fermion is a fermion where adding it and taking it away does exactly the same thing. Okay, and that's what this is. Okay, all right. Okay, so thank you very much.